All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Hey, welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, a CW-2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam. Welcome to our program this couple of days just before Christmas 2024. Holy moly, I'm not sure how that got here so quickly. But I'm really excited to have you here. We've got two great guests today. The first one is going to be Richard Sherman, and he's written a book about, actually, it's a book of photographs of all of the cemeteries overseas where all of the military people who were killed overseas are. And it's a great story. I'm anxious to talk with him about it. It's entitled Never Home is part of it. It's Honoring Heroes Who Never Returned. Excuse me, I got to get this right. And so I'm really excited to talk with him. In the second half of the program, we've got another gentleman. His name is Robert Colella, and he is an Army veteran, and he's going to be talking about his two tours in Iraq and what he's been doing trying to help this generation of veterans record their stories. So stick around. I think you're going to find this rather interesting today. All right. So, you know, we always have to start the program by thanking our sponsors, because we can't do this program without their support. And we really do appreciate them. So number one, of course, is Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans specializes in veterans disability claims. So call Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 or go to their website. That's legalhelpforveterans.com. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for the certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, you can go to their website, nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. Remember out there, all of you veteran-owned business owners, if you want to do business with the federal government, you got to be certified as a real live veteran-owned business. And it's kind of a process that you have to go through. And this is what the National Veterans Business Development Council does. They'll help you through that process. Again, that number is 888-237-8433. PyroClean, known as the paramedics of property damage. PyroClean provides water damage remediation, flood water removal, fire and smoke damage remediation, mold removal, and biohazard cleanup to commercial and residential customers. The reason we're talking about PyroClean around here is that they're also one of the nation's leading restoration franchise networks, and it's made up of entrepreneurs just like you. And veterans get 25% off their franchise fee. So for more information, go to PyroClean.com. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor. For more information, go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. And the National Vietnam Veterans of America. Never again will one generation of veterans abandon another. For more information, go to their website, vva.org. On a local level, we've got Irwin Presscorn American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. If you'd like to support Veterans Radio, please go to our website, veteransradio.org. Click on the donate button and thank you in advance. Make it a good year. We're really excited. Okay, and into the program now. All right, so number one is I want to bring him right on and then we'll talk about how what he did to preserve, the American military history, I think. So I want to bring on Navy veteran Richard Sherman. So Richard, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Dale, thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Well, all right. So this idea of your book, and maybe you can describe the book to our audience first, and we'll get into that. So why don't you tell me what is in your story?
Yeah, the book is Never Home, Remembering the Military Heroes Who Never Returned, and it honors the men and women who died in World War I and World War II and who are interred overseas, thus the title Never Home. So there's some 207,000 or more individuals that are memorialized in the 23 American overseas military cemeteries And those cemeteries are maintained by a magnificent organization known as the American Battle Monuments Commission. As we were talking about beforehand, Dale, before the show started, these are immaculately maintained cemeteries and final resting places for over 200,000 of our brethren. Of course, most folks know Normandy, but there are 22 others, and they're located on three continents. In the book, I travel to all these cemeteries. I'm a professional photographer, and I wanted to go on this journey of gratitude and go and thank the individuals that I've never met for the freedoms and the privileges that I enjoy in my life today. And I decided to bring my camera gear along with me so that I could bring others and share the images with all of you. So the book has about, it has 240 pages. It has over 225 photographs. The overwhelming majority are the ones that I've photographed, but there are also 54 distinct biographies in chapter two that tell the brief stories, the brief histories of the individuals who never made it home. Some of them, unfortunately, are, the biographies include brothers, and in one case, the Sullivan brothers that are memorialized over in Manila. There are five of them. But anyway, it has 54 biographies, and I tell a little bit about the individuals who never made it home. The faces, the pictures of those individuals, of course, those are not my pictures. They've gotten through public sources, many of them from families, some of them from newspapers and other sources. So the book has 225 plus photographs. It has 54 biographies, and it honors the World War I and World War II individuals who have never made it home.
Well, you can tell when you look at the pictures in this book that they are done by a professional. So you've really got a great eye, I must say, the ones that I saw. How did this whole thing start? How did you decide that you were going to do this? What motivated you?
Well, like you, Dale, and your listeners, I'm a veteran, and so the stories of those who have gone before us are serves as a part of our culture, a part of our motivation, and in our service is to honor those who have gone before us and who've served before us, and to keep up the great traditions of the Army or the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard, the Navy, the Air Force. It's after leaving active duty, I was worked in at the Pentagon for a couple of years as a reservist, and those that culture really leaves us as veterans, I think. I came from a lot of relatives in my family, including my father was a Navy veteran, but it really you kind of cemented this idea cemented itself in 2007 when I was working at that time in the financial services career, and I met a I traveled to Vancouver, Canada for a conference, and I got into a cab, and I like to chat. So I was speaking to the cab driver. I jumped in, and 2007 was a time when we were in Gulf War II, and the Canadians had a different perspective on the war than we did. And so the cabbie said, "Hey, where are you coming in from?" I said, "New York." I said, "But I don't think we're so popular up here in Canada right now." And he said, "Oh no, I'm a World War II veteran from the Ukraine." And we had this most fascinating conversation. And he proceeded to tell me these incredible stories from his experience serving in World War II, two pieces of which stood out and really became the background for the book. One was, here he was, a young man in World War II, starving, freezing, facing the Nazi war machine in front of him. His brethren, the Russian Red Army, beating them and shooting them and abusing them, he was overwhelmed in telling the story. I just remember this because he would look back in the rearview mirror and he had these blue eyes. He's probably in his 80s at the time, but blue eyes like the color of a glacier. And we had this amazing conversation. He said, even in his 80s, he couldn't understand why the American forces, these young men, would leave their home. They didn't need to come to the Ukraine. Why would they come? He could even in his 80s couldn't understand, but was extremely grateful that the American GI came and fought alongside them. The conversation proceeded, and this backdrop of war and death and misery and cold and these attempts to survive. He shared this very warm experience. When he was a young man in the fighting with the Red Army, he would only eat every 4 or 5 days. In his own country, there was no food. It's winter. There's where the fields are destroyed, and It was a desperate time for them. And here, thousands of miles from home, the American forces with the logistics, which is often overlooked by the media, the critical role of logistics in war fighting, the American troops had their rations to eat. And against this, there was this human connection where the American GIs would share their food with him and his colleagues. And even now, as I tell that story, I get a little emotional about it, to that human connection, that intimacy, that brotherhood, right? And so that got me thinking about, oh my, how I had got to do something to thank these guys. And that's where the background of the book started.
As I was listening to you to tell that, I'm kind of flashing back here on my own, to Vietnam. And then the American servicemen and women are just amazing people. And even when I was in Vietnam, we would always share our rations with the kids that would come running around. Sometimes you'd go into a village and the people were starving, and we'd end up giving them our C rations, especially the ones we didn't want. But
Food is food.
And I was thinking about that, and there's a book out there that's called called A Thousand Tears Falling by a Vietnamese woman named Young Kral, Krall, and she was ended up being kind of a spy for the North and the South Vietnamese and all this other stuff. But the gist of the book was telling her story. And at the end of our interview that we did probably 15 years ago now, she said, "I still want to thank the Americans." And we said, I said, "What? What did we do?" And she says, "You gave us 10 years of freedom that we had never had in 1,000 years." And I thought, at the time, and just as you mentioned, I'm thinking it over all over again, it made it worth it. And all the bad images, all the bad stories, all the bad welcome homes and all that other stuff, here is this Vietnamese woman that says it was worth it. And so grateful for that. So how did you get to all of these cemeteries?
Let's see. I guess 2007, I told the story about the Ukrainian cab driver, right? And then fast forward, change of career, started studying photography, did a few mentorships with some professional photographers, and now it's 2017, and I believe my skill level has gotten to the stage where I can do something. And so I engage a woman who's very well known, named Mary Virginia Swanson. She is the consultant on creating photography books for some very famous photographers, as well as less famous photographers like myself. And we started working together in 2017 on how we would come together and put this together. I started contacting the American Battle Monuments Commission, which I said, earlier, does a great job maintaining the cemeteries. It couldn't have been more hospitable to me. And then in 2018, started getting on booking flights and car rentals and hotels, and started to travel in Memorial Day of 2000 of 18. COVID meant a couple extra years, so it took me 6 years to go to these three continents. It took eight trips to do it. But COVID also was a blessing in the sense is that we now have 54 biographies, whereas maybe I would have only had half of that if I had didn't have this extra time, that extra time to do the research. But yeah, so just started working with the American Battle Monuments Commission. I had this idea that the biographies, obviously, there's a number of Medal of Honor recipients. There are generals, there are artillerymen, there's infantrymen, but it also includes other groups because I wanted it to be relatable to not just the veterans that have served, but also to the civilians who could understand or relate a little bit better to some of the other fields that we have in our army and navy and services. So there's a number of doctors, there are a number of nurses, ambulance drivers, there's some OSS, which was a predecessor of the CIA, spies that were involved, women who worked for the Red Cross canteen service, for example. So they're not just the trigger puller and the war fighter, but those who are in support and logistics, merchant mariners as well that are in there, that go into this whole machine, this whole organization that allows us to be effective in combat.
Many of us, I'm sure many people listening to this have been to a national cemetery of some kind, whether it's Arlington or any of the other ones that are across the country. And somehow they're beautiful in their own way. Of course, they're a little depressing sometimes when you know, at these perfect rows, just row upon row, and you think about the sacrifice. And I think this is one of the things that we talked about earlier on, is that I think you and I are afraid that the newest generation of Americans coming up don't know these stories, don't, you know, they don't get an opportunity to learn about it in school as much, because everything seems to be more toward the STEM projects, and, you know, history's been kind of played around with in various educational ways in various states. And, you know, you don't get to all of these things sometimes during a year. And I was just, I just think that this book is so important. I mean, you know, some people are oral learners and some people are visual learners. And sometimes they just don't get it when a teacher talks about Normandy and what was occurring there. But if they can see the pictures of the results of Normandy, and you know, you said there are over 207,000, you know, veterans in these cemeteries across the world, it kind of gives you an idea of the sacrifices that were paid and how many of those 207,000 had families, and how many of those 207,000 had wives and had children who never, you know, got to see them again. Yeah. Those are the things that I keep thinking about.
Yeah, I would say there's so much unpacked there, and I know our time is limited, but I would agree with you across the board on everything you really said there about, you know, lack of really, you know, really teaching the individual histories. We may know a little bit about Normandy or D-Day, or we learn a little bit in high school, but this book, like what you do, is really, you know, about connecting to individuals and people, and they had, as you mentioned, loved ones and people that they loved, and they never made it home. And that's, you know, we can talk all about in the media or in TV or whatever, and talk all about, you know, war fighting, and but it's a very, as you know, being a Vietnam veteran, and I'm a Gulf War vet, it's a very intimate experience. It's not about, you know, global perspectives and communism. It's about getting through day to day and getting your job done and taking care of the people around you, and hopefully coming back at night. So yeah, I think this is a human story. This book is a humanist endeavor. It's not really a history book. There are incredible history books. We were talking about some of them before. There's many that your listeners have read and can recommend. This is really about connecting to their lives. And so the histories, the personal histories, I wanted to try to tell a little bit about something about them. You know, they, about their families. Charles Summers, the first killed in action in Europe of the American troops. He was in 6 days. He was 6 days from coming home and getting married when he was killed. He was an aviator, part of an aviation team, was shot down searching for submarines in the North Sea. You know, try to share just an individual piece about their lives, and not just they were part of this unit and this unit took that hill, or they won this battle, but something about this person, because, you know, we owe it to them, and we do have a responsibility of our age is to help these younger folks understand the costs and sacrifice of war. Citizenship comes with great responsibilities. We talk a lot about our rights today. You know, we hear about, we have a right, and that's important. We have to guard and protect our rights, 100%. I'm 100% behind it. But we also have to remember the responsibilities that come with citizenships. We had the draft 3 times the last century.
Yes, I know well about that.
You know it well, right? And we're 25 years into this century. Will we go the next 75 without having a draft? I hope so, but something tells me we won't. And so we have to do our best to share our experiences. And you know, the younger generation, they're very much visual learners as well. And so photography lends itself very well for them to understand and to learn about this experience.
What would you say was the most, I don't know, the overseas cemetery that just struck you the most, either with its beauty or its meaning? I know that's kind of, that's out of left field, but I just was thinking about that.
Yes, I'm going to say yes. That the answer is yes.
Good, we got it. Right.
So, you know, I mean, I had the privilege of going to Normandy twice, including having a press pass for the 75th anniversary, the American Battle Monuments, working with the American, I was lucky to get a press pass. So there I am going in with BBC and, you know, NBC News. And then there's me with my camera gear going in. And that was kind of a cool experience. But to be there and in front of the, I think there's a 2-page spread in the book of a number of the veterans in their wheelchairs or the seats that they provided for them. Many of them could still walk, some of them could not, but it's a very organic photo. It's not a posed photo. They're at the ceremony. But to be, you know, that was that's a life-changing experience. Sure. To be in their presence at the 75th. So it's, you know, and so that would be the one I would have to identify, is that stays with me. And I think about it all the time.
And I'm just thinking, you know, when we talked earlier, we had a gentleman here locally who wrote a book about, there were 76 Vietnam killed, or Vietnam deaths, from our local county here, Washtenaw County in Michigan. And a friend of mine, John Kinzinger, wrote a book about each one of those gentlemen, trying to, you know, who are these, you know, and, you know, because so many of them were 18 years old, 19 years old, and so forth. And they went to local high schools and everything. And in the story, though, he had put down where they were buried. And my wife and I kind of decided we're going to have a little project. And so we went out and we attempted to find all of those tombstones. And most of them were government provided, and they're in the ground, which is, you know, tough to find sometimes in some of these places, because they didn't obviously get the care that they do at the national cemeteries. And so when we were talking about this, I said, I got to figure out how to get these pictures that we took together with the stories that John wrote about these people. And I just got an email this morning, actually, from a gentleman in Toledo, Ohio, who goes around cleaning veterans' gravestones. And I know that this is something that started to happen around the world, I mean, around the country over the last couple of years. But I'm saying, this is like cosmic, something's going on here. Well, all these things that are happening. So, you know, we were talking with Richard Sherman here. He's the author of the book, Never Home, Remembering the Military Heroes Who Never Returned. And it's a beautiful, beautiful book. And I really encourage people to, you know, go and get it. Where can we get this?
Yeah, so the website with all the pictures and the background and my travels is neverhomeheroes.com. And I will say thank you, Dale, for that opportunity to talk about the selling of the book. But there's two things that I really want to emphasize here that I'm extremely proud of. One is that we printed it in the United States of America, right? It's much cheaper to print it in Korea or China, but this had to be done. So it was printed in Wisconsin, in Warzala is a printer. They did a magnificent job. Warzalla. They were extremely supportive of this project, and so I'm grateful for them. And we got it printed in the United States. It costs more, but this is an American project, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's really proud of is that, you know, it's hard to buy a photography book for less than $50 or $60 today, and we've kept this price under $30. It's $29.50 because we wanted this to be accessible to everyone. It wasn't just, you know, folks of significant means, or it's not just a corporate project, but it has to be accessible to everyone, because it's the stories that I want to get out. It's not the money that I want to get, right? It's the stories that I want. If the money comes, the money comes. It's cost a lot of money out of my own pocket to go do this, but it's a journey of gratitude, and I was honored to do that, right? So we've kept this price as low as possible. We print it in the United States because it's the stories. That's the goal of the project, is to get the stories out. The goal of the project is not a commercial goal. It's to get these stories out. And so we're very proud to have it printed in the United States by Warzala, and to have it at a price point that's accessible to people.
Where do I buy the book?
You can go to www.neverhomeheroes.com, and there's a, you just click on it, it says buy the book, and it takes you to the buy the book page, and it'll take you through that process.
Okay. All right. I want to make sure that we can get a hold of the copy of this copy of this book. That's the whole point here today, is to make sure that people do this, because, you know, I'm so grateful to that you reached out to us here at Veterans Radio, and, you know, to tell your story. And then, you know, there's a whole lot more of this background to this story, and we unfortunately don't have time to go into, and your background as far as the Navy and your family and so on and so forth. But it's just great. You know, you mentioned, we got about 3 or 4 minutes here left, Richard. I'm not done with you yet.
Okay.
You mentioned that you did approximately 50, 54 biographies in there. Can you tell us about one of them that really stood out for you?
Well, I mean, there's a number of them that are really important. I don't think that there's 54 that are important. They're all
Yeah.
important, right?
Well,
I mean, I
what
wish I
would
could do more.
yeah.
And then, my wife eventually had to corral me and said, "Look, you got to get the book published. Stop doing research on biographies. Get the book out because they all deserve to be remembered." I'd love to talk about the Tester brothers just for a second. There are three brothers that are interred and buried side by side in Henri Chapelle. Like a number of our cemeteries have brothers next, a sad. I don't know the total number, but have a large number of brothers laying side by side next to each other. Unfortunately for the Tester brothers, three of them, and it's the only three brothers that are side by side in any of the cemeteries. And it's in Henri Chapelle in Belgium. And so the Tester family was living in Tennessee. And unfortunately, in 1942, Mr. Tester passed away, as well as one of the sons. One had cancer, one had a heart condition. And lo and behold, over the next 3 years, Eliza Tester, the mother, saw three of her remaining four sons leave for war in 1943, in 1944, in 1945 on that homestead, on that farm. She received a telegram from the United States Army indicating that her three of her sons had passed away in each of the 3 years, which is an extraordinary story. Glenn Tester was the youngest of the three brothers, but he was the only one of the three that was married. So Glenn Tester had a son. And when Glenn Tester passed away, his son was a year and a half old. And so Glenn Tester's son is named Frank Tester. Frank Tester lives in Modesto, California. And it has been an extraordinary privilege in my life to have spoken and exchange emails and chatted with Frank Tester. He shared some of the photos of his father from their archives, which is in the book. And I'll try not to get emotional here, but in my experience with him, here he is. He's in his 80s now, and he shared that he's just wanted to meet his father. And he's a man of faith, and he has this belief that soon he will get a chance to meet his father. I mean, over the course of 8 decades, the toll of war. We have, unfortunately, for the Vietnam veterans, your experience coming home wasn't like it was for us in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. People said, "Thank you, thank you for your service," and they say that today, which is we're lucky. But the toll of war also includes families. I think we have to start thanking families for their service, to the nation as well. Husband or wives who are back home raising their children and the sacrifices that family make implicitly. So the Tester brothers lay side by side at Henri Chapelle, and it's an extraordinary story, and it's added immeasurably to my life to know Frank Tester.
I can only imagine. I thought of this very belatedly, in that my mother, my mother, my dad had was in World War II. He was in the Coast Guard of all things, and he figured that he was older. He was 40, 39 when he joined up, and because I think they were drafting to 40, and he says, I cannot be in the infantry. I'm too old for this stuff. And he figured, I'll guard the coast. Well, he ended up guarding the coast of Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and his ship was hit by a kamikaze and all these different things, which I never knew until actually I started doing this radio program. But I was thinking about what my mother must have gone through with him being gone for 2 years, and then not 20 years later, I go off for a year. My father had unfortunately died in the meantime. So here she is, gone through it one time, and now she's going through it again. And I never thought about that. And I think that, maybe for all those veterans that are out there, at least for my generation, if your mom is still alive, you better go thank her. For believing in you, and hoping that you're alive every day that you're gone, because mail took forever to get from one place to another. So I just think that in this book, I think people, when they look at it and they look at the pictures and they read those biographies that you put in there, they're all going to be able to relate to it somehow.
Well, I certainly hope so. And by the way, I love the Coast Guard. Did some service with the Coast Guard. Those guys are extraordinary. And during the wars, we have a number of Coast Guardsmen in the book. In World War One, in fact, the USS Tampa, which was a Coast Guard cutter renamed and be provisioned for the Navy, they went down off of the coast of England. And by that one sinking alone in 1918, the Coast Guard had the greatest number as a percentage of total forces, the greatest percentage loss of forces of any of our services in World War One was the Coast Guard, with just the single sinking of that ship, in addition to the other casualties that they suffered. But the Coast Guard's incredible even to this day, the multitude of their mission. As a Navy guy, I'm just have so much respect for their op tempo. They're always operational, and the experience they have from their junior enlisted to their junior officers to their senior admirals is extraordinary. But the families are important. Hopefully this, thank you for your service. In 50 years' time, people are saying that also to those who are at home as well.
Right, to them and everybody else
Exactly.
that's concerned. I'm gonna keep you on if you don't mind for a little bit because my other guest has not signed in yet. And you mentioned the Tesla brothers. You mentioned the Sullivan brothers too. I mean, that's another whole family that was, wiped out in a Navy. Just I don't know what kind of ship it was that was sunk, but
Yeah, the Sullivans went down on a destroyer. A couple of the brothers, five Sullivan brothers, were killed in the Battle of Guadalcanal, and they all went down. They were all on the same ship. So a couple of the brothers had served in the late 30s, early 40s, and had been gotten off of active duty before we had gone to war, and then Pearl Harbor happened, and one of their friends was killed on the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor. And so the five brothers decided to enlist together and to do their duty. The one thing that they asked of the Navy, unfortunately, was that they all serve aboard the same ship. So in January of 1942, they enlisted. They would not make it through the end of the year. They ended up. Their hit their ship was hit by a Japanese torpedo, and then in retreating to a safe area was hit again, and the ship sunk in 42 seconds, killing
Oh.
most aboard. Some of them survived for a couple of days. The oldest of the Sullivan brothers apparently survived on a raft. Their stories, but either died, from being at sea for a long time, or lost his mind, or what have you, but it's not clear. But they all die, and so it's an extraordinary story. The media and the Department of Defense made a big deal out of it because family was doing their duty, right? That was an extraordinary commitment to nationalism and patriotism. Excuse me, not nationalism, but patriotism by the family. And even after the boys were lost, their family continued to travel and tour the country, helping to raise war bonds. And their sister served as a wave even after the five brothers had passed away. An extraordinarily patriotic family, true and true. And even after losing their sons, they continued to help with the war efforts. They are memorialized at Manila American Cemetery. We have one cemetery in Asia, Manila American Cemetery, of course, is in the Philippines. It is our largest by total number memorialized. There are some 17,000 headstones at Manila, well over twice as many as there are at Normandy. Well, hang on a second. There are 17,000. There are about twice as many. Yeah, it would be 18,600 if you doubled it. So just under twice as many. I should correct myself at Manila, but it's an enormous cemetery, and they have those the walls of the missing go on and on. The Indianapolis, who brought the
Right.
material for the they're listed there, as well as the Sullivan brothers are on the walls of the missing, and that image appears in the book as well, which
Well,
is.
again, I want to thank you. We've been talking here with Richard Sherman. The book is Never Home, Remembering Heroes Who Never Returned. You can get the book by going to his website, which is again,
Neverhomeheroes.com.
neverhomeheroes.com. And I want to thank you very much for being on our program, Richard. Have a great holiday season.
Still, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you very much. And thanks to your sponsors and to your listeners for joining today.
Okay. Thank you. All right, we're going to take a real quick break here and do our Medal of Honor segment. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Bobby Coelho, and his book is entitled Batter for Bakuba in Iraq. So stick around. We'll be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith gave his life to protect his troops. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
On April 4th, 2003, a call went out for a place to put some Iraqi prisoners. Sergeant First Class Paul Smith volunteered to create a holding pen inside a walled courtyard. Soon, Iraqi soldiers, numbering perhaps 100, opened fire on Smith's position. Smith was accompanied by 16 men. Smith called for a Bradley, a tank-like vehicle with a rapid-fire cannon. It arrived and opened up on the Iraqis. The enemy could not advance so long as the Bradley was in position. But then, in a move that baffled and angered Smith's men, the Bradley left. Smith's men, some of whom were wounded, were suddenly vulnerable. Smith could have justifiably ordered his men to withdraw. Smith rejected that option, thinking that abandoning the courtyard would jeopardize about 100 GIs outside, including medics at an aid station. He manned a 50 caliber machine gun atop an abandoned armored personnel carrier and fought off the Iraqis, going through several boxes of ammunition. As the battle wound down, Smith was hit in the head. He died before he could be evacuated from the scene.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit veteranscrisisline.net. Veteranscrisisline.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
Right, we're back here on Veterans Radio, and joining me on the line right now is a new friend of Veterans Radio, and I'm anxious to talk with him. His name is, the book is First Sergeant Robert Colella. The book is entitled Battle for Bakuba, and I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but I'm going to call him by what he tells me to call him, and that's Bobby. So, Bobby, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Dale, thanks. First, you got my last name right, and you also got the title of the book right, so you're about 1,000, man. Appreciate you having me on, Dale. Thank you.
Hey, I've been practicing my linguistics here so to make sure I get it right. So, Bobby, the story is, you know, the Battle of Bakuba. I don't think many of us are even familiar with that. And I guess we should back up a little bit and say, okay, so when were you in the service, and how did you get to Bakuba?
I joined the United States Army in October of 1989. And just worked my way through the ranks. And, as fate would have it, I did my first tour in Ramadi in 2004, 2005 as a infantry platoon sergeant. Also had the opportunity to fight in Operation Phantom Fury in November of 2004. That was the Second Battle of Fallujah with the 2nd Infantry Division. And then from my first tour, I redeployed and wound up going to Fort Hood, Texas, and became a company first sergeant. And we had about a 1 year spin up from the time I landed at Fort Hood, about a year to work and train up the units and deploy. And when we went, actually, let me back up. I wasn't a company first sergeant during the train up. I was actually a brigade master gunner. And during the train-up phase and all the way up to deployment into Kuwait, and that's why I became a company first sergeant. But we didn't even know we were going to Bakuba. We were being held in Kuwait as a brigade-ready reserve or theater-ready reserve. And within a couple weeks of us being on the ground in Kuwait, they gave us the word that we're going to go ahead and push north up into Bakuba, which is about 40 miles north of Baghdad. So I had, like you, I had never heard of Bakuba before, but next thing you know, we're there. And yeah, so that was right around October of 2006.
Okay, because the thing I found really interesting in reading your book, Bobby, was the whole idea of this logistics. You know, I don't think many people think about, you know, moving a battalion or a, you know, brigade or whatever size unit it is from Fort Hood, you know, to Kuwait and then, you know, into Iraq. And you cover quite a bit of that in your book. That was...
Yeah, that's a huge logistical undertaking. So we have, you know, Bradleys, tanks, you know, heavy equipment, recovery vehicles, armored personnel carriers, you know, all of that has to go on railheads right there at Fort Hood, which is now Fort Cavazos, onto ships. And then next thing you know, they wind up in Kuwait. And then, you know, you're offloading them in Kuwait and onto trucks and trying to get them to Camp Buren and then eventually to push north. And more often than not, they go on trucks up into Iraq as well. You don't drive them. They get loaded up on Hemets or Hets and they truck them up. And yeah, but absolutely hats off to all the logistics folks out there. Definitely some unsung heroes there.
Absolutely. I was thinking about that. You know, when I was reading the book, I was going, you know, okay, I flew helicopters. Well, how did the helicopters get there? And where did all the spare parts come from? And all of those types of things. It's, you know, we really have to thank all the people in the background. You know, I think the story is something like, you know, it takes 9 people that are not on the front to support the one that's on the front. And anyway, yeah, I just wanted to, if people want to read this story about what it takes to get this whole unit up north, I thought that was really interesting. And you talk about once you got to Bakuba that you were taking over for another company that was there, correct?
Yeah, it was actually, there was a brigade previously in our sector, and we wound up as a battalion taking over that area. And of course, one-on-one company, what they call relief, RIPs or relief in place. And we wound up doing it's about a 2-week process to do a relief in place with the units. And, you know, with all things said, it seemed like it was a pretty quiet, you know, there was some engagements and some insurgent attacks and what have you, but you know, it originally didn't seem like it was going to be that big of a fight up in Bakuba, but that quickly changed within about a month of us taking over.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about, before we get into the actual fighting that you got involved with, was trying to transfer some of these equipment. You have some stories in there about the typical Army. I can't use all of the acronyms that are listed in the book and will get thrown off the air if I use the true words. But that some of the equipment that you inherited wasn't in the best condition.
No, it wasn't. A lot of the equipment, you know, it's just unit after unit. They have some equipment that just stays over there. And, you know, it just gets passed from unit to unit to unit, and it just gets worn down over time. So you're hoping for the best, but also prepared for the worst, you know. And to complicate things really was we were an infantry company, and the landholders that were out there that we actually did the relief in place with was an engineer company. So we were actually getting equipment you know, I was signing for excavators and you know, various engineering equipment that I had no idea how to use it or what have you, or did I have anybody trained on it? So that was kind of an interesting, you know, curveball thrown at us. But, you know, we're infantry guys and we adapt and overcome for sure.
Can you kind of tell our audience, I'm talking here with Robert Coelho. He's a retired first sergeant. The book is Battle for Cuba. It's called Killing Our Way Out. Can you tell me what kind of the job of a first sergeant, you know, because it's, you know, I was an E3 and then I was a warrant officer. I didn't know all about the people in between.
Yeah, well, you know, the first sergeant, the big thing is that they say beans and bullets, right? And really, the most experienced non-commissioned officer in the company. I am the company commander, sounding board. You know, we had a great relationship. I had two company commanders while I was over there. But really, it's taking the brunt of all the administrative stuff, all the you know, working with XO with the logistics side and the maintenance and the ammo and the food and the security out the combat outposts and, you know, just making sure that all of that is taken care of is one thing that the company commander should not have to worry about. And they can focus on the fight. They can focus on what the battalion commander wants them to do. They can focus on what the enemy's doing out in sector. You know, so it's really just taking care of the troops and minimalizing the distractors for the company commander so he can focus on the fight and command those platoons and have them execute what needs to be executed out in sector.
Well, in your book, you also talk about not only what occurred in Bakuba, but you also talk about some of the things that a leader has to be. And one of the things that you did mention was a leader has to get out in the field and see what, you know, see what's actually going on. And, you know, and that's one of the issues that many people have with sometimes with leaders, especially in the military, who don't necessarily go out in the field with you, but you wanted to get out there with your men, correct?
100%. You can't make those decisions. You can't be the sounding board for the company commander without having a you know, good operational picture. And you can't get that operational picture by reading situation reports and debriefs and stuff like that. You have to go out there and you have to see the soldiers. You have to see, you know, to be able to look into their eyes and see the fatigue, to look into their eyes or have that long conversation with them while they're on guard and listen to what the troops are telling you, what the platoon sergeants are telling you, what the platoon leaders are telling you. But, you know, it's also a balance, man. You don't want to be, you know, smothering them and micromanaging. But at the same time, you have to find that ability to get out there, keep your finger on the pulse, understand the area of operation so you can make good decisions and, you know, at the same time, be hands-off enough to where you're not stifling the platoon leaders and platoon sergeants, letting them go out and get after it like they need to.
Right. Well, yeah, because, you know, the leaders don't have to be out in the field all the time, but it's not a bad idea if they're out there at all. And I know that you ran into a number of different firefights and lost a few friends over there.
I certainly did. You know, our company for the fight, so we wound up on the bonus program over there. So, you know, the troop surge was announced in, I think, like January, February timeframe, and the extension. So we actually wound up doing a 15-month deployment. And within those 15 months, starting in December, we took our first killed in action. We were manning a combat outpost in a small town called Baritz. And the insurgents, you know, it used to be a Iraqi police station, and the insurgents overran the police station, killed, chased off the occupants of it. One of our units, not my company, but our engineering company, Echo Company, went down, retook that ground, but our engineers were also starting to spin up and do route clearance missions to keep the main supply routes and what have you open. So the call was made to send Bravo Company 112 down there to do a relief in place with War Dog. And within a couple of days, December 23rd, actually tomorrow, being the anniversary, is they launched an all-out attack. It was overcast. The helicopters weren't flying. We usually had attack aviation units that would be our angels on our shoulders. But the insurgents knew what they were doing. We were there, and they just started dropping mortar rounds and indirect fire, rockets, machine gun fire, precision fire, and they also try to coordinate an assault. And to the point where one of our platoons were called in to do an ammo resupply, and as the tank was backing up to the outpost, so to minimize exposure to the dismount, so they didn't have to come out and get the ammunition. As they were backing up, a mortar round landed on top of the tank and killed the gunner, Corporal Barta. And that was our first kill in action that day. And it also disabled the tank. And, you know, it was a pretty tough fight. That was kind of like the moment in time where we knew a lot of things had shifted. When the insurgents are doing a coordinated attack, they were able to drop, in our company logs, we lost count at, I believe, 77 indirect rounds. When do a coordinated attack, it was like, hey, these insurgents are well equipped, well trained, and
they know what they knew what they were doing.
They mean business, man. They mean business. So
yeah. Well, we're running out of time, unfortunately, sure. Bobby, and I got to get you in to talk about it. I only have a minute left for you to talk about it. But that is your debrief project, and can you tell me what you're doing with that?
Yeah, so the debrief project. So, you know, our company, we lost 14 people out of our company. I think 28 or 29 people out of our battalion. It was a pretty kinetic fight. We never really had a chance to talk about it. And writing my book, I found healing in storytelling. And just to, you know, encapsulate it is, I want to give everyone an opportunity to share their story. So I'm focused on going around debriefing with soldiers from my company, my battalion, sniper teams, Special Forces, 520 Infantry that came up and support us during the troop surge, and the aviators. So, you know, I'm going to travel around the country, giving people an opportunity, long-form opportunity, you know, sit down hours, 2-3 hours to tell their story and their view of their military career, and, of course, the fight in Bakuba, because it was such a pivotal battle. That was a place where the insurgency's backbone was broken during a troop surge, and it was really the insurgents' Alamo, and we crushed them, man. We did, and it's a story that needs to be told. And, you know, we just released a press release. We're hoping to get a documentary going. We would like to get some support with the documentary. As I'm doing these interviews, they're amazing. You could go to our website. We're on YouTube, the debriefproject.org. We're on Facebook, YouTube, you know, all the normal places, but you could get a better understanding of what our mission is and what our purpose is. But really, it's a huge undertaking, but it's certainly a worthy cause, because there was an awful lot of sacrifice. And there was an awful lot of heroics that it would be great to give these people a voice and share their story, of not just their story, but their unit story. And of course, the Bartas and the other, you know, soldiers that lost their lives over there that never had a chance to come home. But,
right.
You know,
well, Bobby, we got to go.
Yeah, man.
But we got to go. So look up the debriefproject.com. So we got to get out of here. We want to wish Merry Christmas to everybody who's listening. We're going to go out on a partial song that I wanted to hear play the whole thing, but it's called All I Want for Christmas by the U.S. Army Band. You are dismissed.
I don't want a lot for Christmas. There is just one thing I need. I don't care